an omnidirectional?
I just learned how to use it about 2 hours ago, so I was like, I better teach myself how to use this so I'm gonna interview people. Okay, if you could just state your name for the record, please.
David Carlton, known here as Cobb.
Okay. Cobb, my first question is, how did you come to get involved in this intentional community?
That's a short question with a long answer.
Okay, go for it.
I'm married with three children. Been married for, what?
Almost 15 years.
Three boys. Grew up in a traditional suburban family. We were a traditional suburban family. And used to have work in a downtown office, beyond 9 to 5, like everyone else, to earn enough money to pay all the bills and maintain that suburban lifestyle, and got kind of tired of it because I felt like I didn't know my own family very well. And about 4 years ago, I was in the position where I was actually able to work from home and telecommute, which was a good change, mm-hmm. made a big difference, and had been doing that for a few years, and had been talking with some friends about finding some other way of living. And just one of the things that appealed to us was like a working farm bed and breakfast that we do cooperatively with other people, and had some educational aspect to it, but was definitely more of a rural lifestyle than a city lifestyle. And a friend of ours had insomnia one night and was surfing the web and found intentional communities and in particular Dancing Rabbit, and got all excited about it and wanted my wife to come with her to visit. And it looked like, hey, this would be a great family vacation kind of thing to do. And it happened to fit within my workload, my workflow. So we all came out to visit. And our friend ended up not staying, but we did. We fell in love with the place and came back as residents to see if it was really what we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And almost a year ago was when we first heard about the place.
Okay.
But, you know, this past winter, we decided that we wanted to live here full time. Okay. And I still work remotely. I still telecommute for my clients in New York mm-hmm. City and elsewhere. And spend a lot more time with my family, with the boys, raising, you know, growing our own food, and just being, living in a much more, at a slower pace. Living according to our values is how I'm being prompted by my wife. Yeah, that's definitely a part of it. I mean, it's mm-hmm. It's very hard to be environmentally aware and conscientious in suburbia, where everything is geared toward, where the infrastructure requires that you drive everywhere, mm-hmm. even for play dates. You know, our best friends were not our next door neighbors. Our best friends lived, 12 miles away? And we were constantly driving everywhere to see people, to have play dates, to do things, to both educational opportunities, for the kids to play with the people that we felt good about and shared our perspectives on things, and you know, grocery shopping, any little thing. It mm-hmm. just, you know, we could bike or walk to the post office and the bank. That was about it. Right. Everything else, we had to get in the car and drive somewhere. I shudder to think of the hours that we've spent cooped up in the car all these years. Okay. What a waste of time.
Yeah, absolutely. So you didn't have like a predisposition to this, then. This was a lifestyle change that you made as a result of not being satisfied with your previous lifestyle.
Can you have me interview too?
Yeah, please speak up if you have a question.
This can be a joint thing. Say who you are for the record.
I am Amy Carlton, and I'm known as Meadow here. And we had been part of a CSA, a Community Supported Agriculture, so we were involved in that sort of thing. We had a we were increasingly environmentally aware of how our decisions affected the world, and we had a compost pile. We're doing gardening, tried to make our house less wasteful. We've always shied away from a consumer lifestyle, but certainly did a lot more reusing and recycling after, you know, as we gained knowledge about mm-hmm. how our actions affected the world. And so we've been talking about a lot about our dissatisfaction, that we really, that was really hard to live our values. It was just, it was sad to us each day that we wanted to make a difference, and we wanted to be part of the solution, and yet really we were stuck in this lifestyle that was not part of the solution.
The infrastructure that we had to live with almost really inhibited our ability to live our values. I mean, the faith community that we were part of, very kind of on the liberal side of, you know, the Presbyterian Church, mm-hmm. big city, or one of the big churches in the city, dedicated to social justice and a large number of people who are, I guess you'd call them green.
Mm-hmm.
We had to, you know, it was a half-hour drive into the city to go, right. just to go to church and to be with people whose values were consonant with our own. And the whole idea of living in a community where everyone shares those common values was kind of a you know, wow, I could have had a V8 moment. What a concept.
Yeah.
And I mean, I remember one day realizing, hey, you know, we're putting out one garbage barrel that's not even full and five recycle boxes, and our neighbors have one recycle box that's not full and multiple garbage bins. You know, we're just not on the same page.
And people would complain about our compost pile, like yeah. it was...
or the fears that it would be smelly or something, which of course it isn't.
And we also didn't spray our lawn, which is like a big no-no.
Oh yeah,
no-no.
We did not use Chemlawn.
Oh, right.
Those are terrible neighbors.
We had, God forbid, we had dandelions in our lawn.
Yeah.
You know? And to get grief from the neighbors because of this just seemed...
It was exhausting.
To
be fringe in a way.
And yet, after we were in that house for 8-9 years, after a few years of not applying pesticides and, you know, only mowing what we really, really, really had to because, you know, it was blooming, we had more wildlife diversity, birds, songbirds, that we didn't have the first year we were in the house. I mean, it just, there were more, every year there were more, and they came to our yard because there were bugs, because there were seeds, because there were things available to them. And it was kind of amazing to watch and to realize how much we had been missing without knowing it, without noticing. And coming out here to the middle of nowhere, USA, we've been similarly astounded at the wildlife diversity in birds and mammals and butterflies and insects and everything. It's been
astounding. Yeah, we really
fell
in love. We fell in love with the wildlife, and we fell in love with the stars so we could see at night, because over the years that we lived at our house, there was an influx of wild space taken for big box stores, and so the light pollution was pretty severe by the time we left, and it went from us being able to see the stars when we first moved there to it being obscured, and that was
a lot of light pollution.
Yeah,
Where are you from, if you don't mind me?
We're from upstate New York, okay. Rochester, you know, up near Lake Ontario.
We lived in Webster for 9 years, but David grew up in
Rochester. Yeah, I was born and raised in that area. Always in, you know, my parents built their house in the outer ring, the suburbs. And, you know, we come from a, I guess, for lack of a better term, traditional, you know, middle class America. Mm-hmm. And had, in the Finger Lakes region, you know, my grandparents had built a cabin in the Finger Lakes, and so we could get away from the quote-unquote city. It's not really a city by many standards, but you know, if you come from New York City, it's it's a hamlet. But so yeah, we had. I thought I knew what the country was like. And you drive out to the country, and you're in the woods, and you hear the birds, and you see the stars. And, you spend the weekend and by the lake, and then you, you know, go back home. And I thought I knew what the Milky Way looked like. Thought I knew what the constellations looked like. You know, Orion's bow was like these three or four stars that you could see. Mm-hmm. Here it's like a dozen. You see the arc. And you can really understand why people saw these pictures in the stars, because here you can see them away from all the light pollution. That's nice.
We're also attracted by the community side of things. That it's so freeing to just walk over to the common house and have a meal with other people, or have something going on in the common house in the evening, or be invited over to somebody else's house, or having people in here, and just being able to walk home. And
it's just next door.
And seeing people who we know, and not having cars zipping by our house, was huge. I mean, just having the boys be able to go out and play, and being, you know, on 280 acres of just beauty, and I feel like it's, even though we're living, we went from a 2,200 square foot house to a 570 square foot house, and they all went from having their rooms to sharing one.
Three boys in one small room, triple bunk. They love it.
But I think that they like it, and they've all expressed recently that they'd much rather be here than back east. And I think the nature component is a big part of that they can just go out and be with other people, and that there are adults that they can connect with too. If somebody's working, they can kind of see what they're doing. And that's really what I wanted for them, to not just be in our house, in our yard, and then get in the car, and we have to get in the car for everything. Like here, they're actually part of village life. And it's, I just think that's such a huge gift, and something that most people don't have anymore.
And it's a village life in a way that I think a lot of mainstream culture has lost, because you think of neighborhoods, or you think of villages, and you know, when we were growing up, when we were young in the 60s and 70s, when you trick-or-treated, for example, you went from door to door. You didn't go down driveways and down the street and then up the next driveway. And somehow, in the intervening years, since we've become adults and had children of our own, there are these psychological barriers, even in traditional suburban neighborhoods. You know, the kids can play out in a circle, and if you happen to live in a cul-de-sac, but you don't, at least the adults, you don't walk across lawns. You don't cross hedges. You don't step over a fence or a narrow border garden. You walk down your driveway, down the street, and up the next driveway. Mm-hmm. And there's this, even when there aren't high fences, there is this sense of there are barriers.
It's almost the way the landscape is cut that implies.
Yeah. It's like, that this is mine, that is not
this is
mine.
This is
very, very territorial, very marked. And in suburbia, we knew our next door neighbors, we knew the people across the street, and maybe one house to either side, and there was, you know, our kids played with the kids just around the corner, but we didn't know other people. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we recognized that car, and sometimes people waved as they go by, but here in the Midwest, total strangers wave to you. It's kind of cool.
You love the wave factor.
I'm finally, after a few months, I'm getting the hang of driving and waving at the same time. Every finger
what
lift.
Do they want?
You're driving out here, you must be a neighbor.
Exactly, yeah.
There's just that sense here at Dancing Rabbit, even though the personal spaces are much smaller, and even if there are garden fences or what have you, there isn't the same sense of there being a barrier. Mm-hmm. These are people that you live with and that you know and that you see every day, and you eat meals with once or twice a week, if not more.
You go to meetings with.
You go to meetings with. You know what's going on in their lives. You know how they're feeling about things.
You know, when they're sick and you can help them out, and when you're sick, they help you out. Mm-hmm. Boy, that when David went out of town last time, I got really sick. Mm-hmm. And I had so much help. It was amazing.
Spontaneous.
And
unasked
I think,
for
you know, even in, you know, where we lived, yeah, we knew a couple neighbors, but there was never a sense that I could call and ask for help. You know,
yeah.
It wasn't the same kind of thing. And here, you don't even have to ask for help. The word goes out that you're sick, and it's like, how can we help?
There's, I think here there's also, everyone holds a sense of, there's a sense of what's good for the community. In that, if someone is struggling or having a hard time, even if it's inconvenient for you, you drop what you're doing and you help them because their success here is important for the whole community, and it is, and there is benefit to you. And you know, in suburbia, there are just so many people, and so many different ways. People are just so busy. There's so much time lost commuting. So much time lost in the car doing errands. People are overwhelmed with email and scheduling and calendars, and are just driven, rushing from this thing to that thing to the other. And here there's a sense of, well, I was going to do that today, but so-and-so is having an emotional crisis, or is having a health crisis, or is, needs another pair of hands to get that post in the ground or something. I'll stop, I'll drop what I'm doing for 15 minutes and spend time with them. And trusting that when I'm in a tight spot, someone else will spontaneously step in and help me. And it mm-hmm. it changes the whole dynamic of how people relate to one another. There's a sense of safety. It's more tribal, more like extended family than it is your typical neighbor. Who might be a nodding acquaintance, or who you might have nothing in common with. Mm-hmm. But they're nice, and so you smile and you wave, and you know.
We're also a good number for this sort of thing, and I kind of wonder what's going to happen when it gets bigger, because there have been ideas that some. I think originally when they started the village, they wanted it to get to be about 500 people, and. Right now we do everything by consensus, so we have meetings and you know, all consents to decisions. But how is that really going to work when there are 500 people that need to consent? And
I would like to clarify that consensus, because I work with nonprofit boards and volunteer boards of directors for a living, there is the sense that consensus means people are okay with it, even if they vote no. It's not. You know, there might be a majority agree and say, well, okay, go do what you want, but I don't agree with you, but I'm not going to stand in your way.
Yeah.
It's not true consensus.
Yeah.
Here, consensus means every single person votes yes. And if one person isn't sure or wants to step back or step aside, it's not consensus. So when you have emotional issues or... even just practical issues on what should the policy be around free roaming dogs? What are the boundaries? There's a lot of discussion,
mm-hmm.
and it takes a long time, and there's a lot of energy that goes into it. But then when everyone agrees, then you don't have confusion, you don't have problems down the road. But it works for what do we have? 40 people, 40 adults roughly.
Mm-hmm.
How is that going to work when you get up to 500? How is it going to start to break down? And when are we going to start replicating mainstream society structures that just because the numbers require it? It's a big experiment. It's kind of fun to be part of, but it is very much an experiment.
Yeah. Is the community really split on the idea of expanding versus keeping it small when you guys meet together about it?
I don't think that we really meet about that. I think that was set down as kind of an idea that was set up by the founders. And Although I know that there's some people who are really comfortable with slow change. Mm-hmm. I think there are those who'd really like to grow quickly. However, you know, we were lucky that we came here and that this house was here and it was available. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you look out, there aren't any houses built for folks. You have to really come and camp and build, and that's a big challenge. So I think it will continue to be a slow growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a couple things. I think there's disagreement about how rapidly the growth should occur. I mean, there are some things that are community. There's community maintained infrastructure, like the roads, the common house.
Right, we're really outgrowing the common house.
Yeah, restroom
right now.
Facilities, cooking facilities, eating co-ops. There's room for a sub-community to develop. So people who want to be a small, closer-knit group, there's room for that. Like Ironweed is the name of one of them, where there are several individuals who have grouped together, and they eat together, they help each other with their buildings, they jointly run and maintain a large garden and sell the excess produce to other people here in the village, and they're kind of self-identified as a subgroup, a subcommunity. There are people who don't belong to a subcommunity. So there's room for different levels of interaction and defining what your community is. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of awareness. I think there's an unusual degree of self-awareness among the people here in terms of how much energy an individual feels they have to contribute to the community. And so when people talk about growth, it always takes energy and effort to integrate new people. Mm-hmm. So it takes more energy to integrate more people. And so faster growth, slower growth. Different people have different comfort levels. Mm-hmm. So there's discussion that way. I don't think anybody feels that it should stay the size it is. Right. Like everybody has, there's this incredible vision for kind of the ultimate, even though nobody knows exactly what it will look like, there's this wonderful vision for the community, for a new town center that right now is just open prairie. Mm-hmm. But everything is very clustered and dense, so there's a lot of open space for garden and agriculture and wild space and open skies kind of thing. I had another thought at the beginning of this whole phrase and I lost it.
Can I go back to the consensus thing?
Consensus, sure.
I have to disagree with something you said about standing aside, because I think there's a difference between standing aside and blocking. Like if somebody blocks a decision, then it can't go forward. But if somebody just chooses to stand aside and not vote, then it can be agreed upon. I just want to...
No, it can be agreed upon. I just, there's an awareness, I think, people
it's a big
who are,
it's a big deal if somebody stands aside.
It is a big deal if someone stands aside. It's unusual. And there are, when someone is facilitating a meeting, if one of the principal participants in a discussion chooses to stand aside, a lot of times there's a sensitivity to not pushing through a decision just to get a decision made, but to really make sure that the person who is standing aside feels that they have been heard, that their concerns have been addressed, that people understand where they're coming from and why they're standing aside. And there's just a lot of room made for people to be heard, which is not the norm in our culture. It's the norm in our culture is, you know, rapid decision making, let's move on, come on, quit dragging your feet. If there's a two-thirds majority, that's great. We're done.
If you want to be heard, you have to drastically stand out. You know, you can't just be you and be part of the decision.
Well, and there's also, I think there's a fair amount of, I think there's a fear of not going along with majority. Because if you don't go along with the majority, you get a lot of grief for it. And there's a lot of derision. There's a lot of, well, what's your problem? Get with the program, right? And here, there's very much a sense of, Everyone holds a piece of the truth. Even if you're out of, quote unquote, out of step with the other people in a meeting, if you're not agreeing with them about something, you do hold a piece of the truth. You're not automatically, what you're feeling, what you're thinking, and your reasoning is not automatically invalidated simply because you're in a minority. Mm-hmm. And so there's a sense of inclusiveness. At the same time, I think one of the challenges that we have as an intentional community, partly because there is no, it's not an income sharing community where there's a village business like some other intentional communities, right. like East Wind, they make nut butters, that's the industry. Twin Oaks mm-hmm. is another one. They have a tofu making operation. They have, you know, they have these industries where you come, you have a place to live, a dormitory to have a bunk in, and you have these work shifts, mm-hmm. and you get fed. You're working in you get your room and board, and you put in your hours. Here, so I guess that's, in some ways, that's more open because anyone can just come and plug in. Here, it's not quite so easy. There is no universal industry. So people who come here either have savings that they can live off of, or they're, I hate to use the term, but they're kind of, you know, the technological elite, and that you can work remotely, you know, doing design, you know, mm-hmm. graphic design, website support, software support, software coding. Mm-hmm. So you can work remotely. Mm-hmm. Because we're not large enough for someone to say, oh, I have an industry making soap.
Right.
You know. and if you belong to one of the eating co-ops, you know, you pay a fee to be part of that co-op, or you buy into, or you're paying rent, you're paying lease fees, and there isn't excess housing, so you're having to, well, it's inexpensive, mm-hmm. you can rent a tent platform for $5 a month, mm-hmm. it's pretty, you know, low-cost living,
yeah.
and that's great for three seasons out of the year,
yeah.
But to tent and build, you know, while you're building, I think that works for a single person or for a young couple. For folks like us, you know, we're in our 40s, we have three kids, and we're not really camping sorts of people.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a huge challenge if the house that we're in had not happened to be available through, you know, serendipitous coincidence. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't work for us. And I guess part of it, I'm really glad it did, because if it hadn't worked out, after having been here and visiting here and staying here for several months through the summer, would have been incredibly hard to go back to our previous existence mm-hmm. as a traditional suburban family.
Do you have any questions? Because we're real talkers.
You're answering all of them right now. this is perfect.
Well, we've had plenty of opportunity to try to explain to our parents why we're doing this, and to siblings, and to friends, and to, yeah, because, you know, I knew where Missouri was. Never in a million years would I have imagined I'd be living here voluntarily.
Yeah, but that's really bad.
I know,
like,
it's a
really regionalist.
It is, yeah. But, you know, I'm from upstate New York, you know, Northeast.
My folks are from Illinois, and I went to school in Minnesota, so I have a greater understanding of...
You're more traveled than I.
Yes, I am.
Well, when you were in school, you traveled to the Far East.
Yes,
and
I have,
you know, you've been around the world.
Places other than Western New York.
Yeah, I'm an upstate New York snob.
Well, I grew up in Kansas, and when I meet people that are from either coast, you know, near big city areas maybe, even but they moved there, I'm like, I honestly, I don't understand. But that's because I haven't really experienced that as a lifestyle, I guess, so.
That's great.
Whenever this topic comes up, I think of the Eddie Murphy movie, Coming to America, where he spins the globe and sticks in the pin, and it's the United States, and wow, such a wealth of possibilities. Where should we go? New York or Los Angeles?
Yeah.
I was born and raised in upstate New York, third tier city, large enough to have a fabulous Philharmonic Orchestra and be on major concert tours, Genesis, and showing my age now, band names, but big bands would come to the city. So we had that, and it was small enough that you didn't have the morning rush hour is 20 minutes long, and if it takes 25, people get all bent out of shape. So in a lot of ways, it's the best of both worlds, and yet it's still so incredibly wasteful. And I guess one of the side effects of living here and living differently is really seeing how out of whack our culture has become, and how unsustainable it is in the long term.
In our humble opinion.
Today I made bagels for the first time. It took me an hour and a half. Okay, I could have gotten in the car and driven 10 minutes to the grocery store and bought some that somebody else made and paid $6 for the privilege and then driven home. Mm-hmm. Or I could spend 50 cents on the raw ingredients and, well, maybe a little bit more because it was ground flour. But if we bought the wheat berries from the neighboring farm and ground it ourselves.
Which we have done.
Call it 50 cents and make it myself. Mm-hmm. The time is money. Mm-hmm.
We become much more conscious of how far things travel, too.
Oh, the embodied energy of things.
It can kind of drive you insane. Like, I remember being back east and kind of having the dilemma of standing in the grocery store going, okay, the organic bananas are in plastic bags, and then the unorganic ones are not. Yeah. Which do I do?
Lesser two evils.
And they both came.
Watch out for you.
From states.
Thousands of miles away.
Who knows what happened on the way over?
Truck.
Dad, can I have a taste?
And we're not purists by any means. Mm-hmm. I mean, although I have that, I think we're idealists. But
we hand grind our Ethiopian coffee.
Yeah, we do. All right, so we get coffee from Ethiopia. We have tried doing soybean coffee, but it just.
Oh, I really
can't do it.
How does that work?
It doesn't.
Oh, it doesn't. Sorry.
It really, really doesn't.
It didn't work for us.
And anyone who swears differently never liked coffee to begin with.
Oh, my goodness.
I have a much greater appreciation for what it takes to do things. When both in terms of time and energy, and part of me feels a little bit simple for not having done it sooner. I mean, I grew up with a family that, my grandparents, my grandmother immigrated from Germany between the wars. And so she grew up in a war-torn society, inflation was insane, they had to grow their own food if they were going to eat at all. So that translated into my parents being children of the Depression and the war. They learned, you had a garden. You grew your own vegetables. So all through my childhood, my parents and my grandparents both grew vegetables, and they canned and they preserved. And somehow our generation didn't seem to carry that. Convenience food, fast food.
We didn't need to.
Became the norm. It was so available, so readily available. Mm-hmm.
So pushed on you, even.
Well, yeah, if you watch TV and
TV,
well, we are the TV generation.
Mm-hmm. You want to tell her about
one night over dinner, my wife and I started naming every single TV show we'd ever watched, from kids through adults, and our kids were just flabbergasted.
They're like, stop, we're playing Kojak.
And even then, 3 years, and then days later, we're remembering more. Oh, I Dream of Genies. The hours of our lives that were just wasted on drivel. Mm. And yet, that was something else, too, is we got rid of the influence of the media, particularly television and commercials, on our children was really astounding. And we got rid of TV for the most part.
We really only watched like PBS for the kids, but I felt like we were really addicted to it. And now we have the joy of being able to get Netflix and stuff, so we can be really choosy about what we do, but I'd say we still are movieaholics.
Well,
but we try to limit it.
That's you and I. It's not our kids. But it just, it was a stagnant.
We kind of not have watch more than one movie a week.
It's funny. We got, without TV, so we're not, you know, we're not spending however many hours a day in front of the boob tube. And without driving everywhere, there's no commute, all those hours have been filled with other things. There still are not enough hours in the day to do everything that we want to do. Mm-hmm. How did we do anything at all when those other things were such an integral part of our lives?
I spent so much time watching TV in the evenings, just folding clothes and doing desk work and stuff. Like, it became my friend. And I really saw over the past 5 years or so that that was not okay with me, and yet there were many options, you know. Occasionally, with close friends, we'd go to each other's house, but then we'd fold laundry and watch TV or something, but to be with somebody else. But,
TV and I felt like,
and I felt like I knew, you know, TV characters more than I knew my neighbors, and that felt really just so sad. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine got this magazine called A Real Life, and I realized, wow, so much of my life is just watching other people's lives. And, you know, I think I use my time wisely. I've always been a multitasker with TV, but still, it became really important to me to watch my show so I knew what was going on. Oh. And I knew TV characters more than I knew friends,
neighbors,
family,
neighbors. We cared more deeply about the American Idol contestants.
Right.
Than we did about the people who lived across the street.
Or what was going on politically, or, you know.
So. Kind of sad, actually.
Yeah.
dare I say pathetic?
Pretty pathetic.
Just hollow. There was no.
It was hollow.
It was all superficial, hollow. Very shallow.
And then when we did get together with the friends, it'd be, it was so.
Can you believe so-and-so got kicked off American Idol?
Yeah, we were talking about what was on TV, that was like a common thing. Although we branched out. In the last 5 years, we were doing things like Women's Circle and Men's Night Out, and they would do jobs with each other, and, you know, we tried to do more interesting things.
And it was so much more fulfilling. I mean, to get together with the guys and, you know, descend on somebody's house and finish a project in 2 hours that would have taken, you know, me several weekends to get through.
Yeah.
And have a good time doing it. You know, laughing and joking, and the time would fly by, and it wasn't work anymore. It was play, and we were connecting with each other and talking about stuff. And doing that once a month.
It wasn't enough.
Here, it's every day.
And it felt very disjointed, too, because you get in the car, zip over, you spend like 2 or 3 hours of intense time with people, and then drive home, and then be back in...
In your own isolation chamber.
Like your isolation. Yeah, it really was very hard for me. Things feel much more fluid here. Like, I can walk out the door and go talk to somebody instead of calling them and actually see them face-to-face.
Or instead of emailing, even.
And I can walk into Rutledge to get groceries if I need them, and I walk with friends, or it feels, and maybe I'm just an overwhelmed kind of person, but it feels much more calming to me, and even if I don't talk to everybody every day, I see them walking by, and it just feels so nice.
I think
it's really what I've always wanted.
You said calming, and I think that's a huge piece of it. Somehow we've been taught to believe that you have to do more, be more efficient, do it faster. And that's so not what we evolved to do. I mean, it's such a recent phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why there's so much depression.
People are so stressed and so depressed
so
and
isolated.
So or isolated or violent or so dysfunctional. It's, you know, I worked even here working remotely. So much of what I do is by email, and there's this expectation that, you know, because email is instantaneous, the response will be instantaneous as well. And here, it's a slower pace. You wake up with the sun when it gets dark. You know, if you don't have solar power, it gets dark, you go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's really cloudy, rainy, and you don't have sufficient power to do stuff, what you do and how you do it and when you do it is so much more tied to the seasons and the weather and I think more natural, primal, subconscious rhythms that we evolved with over millions, you know, thousands or millions of years. And it is not so crazy making. I mean, when you're constantly rushing from this thing to that thing, no wonder people are so stressed out. And here it's, you know, you wake up when it gets light and the birds start singing and there's a clock, but I think the first few months we were here, I still wore my watch, but I haven't worn my watch for months. I have to remember to pack it when I go to New York when I have to travel for clients.
Well, I have to say that things are fairly scheduled here. I mean, with meetings
it's scheduled,
and stuff,
but
and
it's...
No, I think probably my calendar is more full here. but I feel like the time is better spent.
But there's also...
And it's more relaxing, because guess what, on my meeting, I get to go outside and pass by people I know and say hi, or pet a dog, or go get the mail, take a little walk, say hi to the cows.
We're outdoors a lot more.
It feels so much better.
Everyone is very... I think the people who are drawn to attentional communities, at least presently, tend to be more self-aware, more introspective personalities. So, you know, people here who are perceived as extroverts are surprised by that because they've always seen themselves as introverts and maybe in normal society,
mm-hmm.
quote-unquote, would be.
Right.
And there's a huge acceptance of someone saying, I can't do that right now. I'm not in a good place for that, or I don't feel up to it, or I don't have the energy for it. It's, you're not failing, you're not weak, you're not...
People encourage you to take care of yourself.
Yeah, you're not just ducking out of something, you're not slacking, you're just, it's like, okay, good, take care of yourself, that's important. Save the energy for the things that really matter to you the most. And that's so refreshing. It's empowering.
Can I say something about the relationships?
You know, please stop banging that around. It's too loud. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Something that that's been really great for me is that I think I get scared of conflict. And in the past, if there's conflict in a friendship, it's really easy, a long distance, just cut that relationship off and never see that person again. Mm-hmm. And here, I'm going to see that person again. And so I've had to learn, being here, to overcome my fears of actually talking about a conflict and talking to people. And it's been an incredible learning experience for me. I'm always, you know, life is full of conflicts, but to be able to go and say, hi, may I talk with you? Mm-hmm. And I've kind of made this rule for myself now that if I do have a conflict, that I need to go right away and talk to that person or as soon as I can, because it just eats at me otherwise. And then the only person I'm hurting is myself. And lots of times it's a misunderstanding. If I go to the person and say, hey, you know, I noticed this, and it can be, oh, that's totally not what I meant, you know. Mm-hmm. And so my whatever feelings I'm having were unfounded to begin with. So a lot of things I just cleared up by my asking what was going on. And That's been an amazing lesson for me. It's been very hard. It's been scary and hard.
And it's been hard. It's behavior that was not modeled for us by our parents in the new suburbia, the American dream.
I don't think it's modeled very many places.
It's not modeled. No, it's not. Yeah. It's a learned skill that so few people have a lot of exposure to, and I feel very fortunate that our children are. Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's like one of the hopes for the world to, like, if this can be learned, this whole thing of identifying what you're feeling, sharing your feelings and thoughts, and
but it's also in a small community, because we're all there's a commitment to hearing other people too. So if someone comes to you saying, "I have a real problem. I'm having a real reaction to what you said to me," that they actually listen to you, and it may be hard for them also, but there's a commitment to working it out.
And what's nice is there's a support given. If you can't, if you're having troubles working something out with somebody, that mediators can be called in and help. It's such a comfort for those of us who are not, you know, necessarily trained in nonviolent communication, or can have some support while trying to learn how to do it.
Even within our own family, I mean, our oldest son is about to turn 13, and he's, you know, maybe going on 17 in some ways, and so that, you know, whether it's alpha male stuff or just triggers that he and I have with each other, I forget what it. I don't even remember what it was anymore. But he and I were really butting heads, and another adult here was. We asked if she could mediate for us, and she did. And he felt heard. I felt heard. We understood each other better, and it diffused the whole situation. And it. It was remarkable, because I cannot imagine talking.
This is great.
And I just, that sort of thing, I can't imagine having that kind of a conflict be resolved so efficiently, effectively, so lovingly, so caringly, even with friends, certainly not with neighbors. It really is. It's a different way of being. And we miss our friends terribly. There are things, conveniences. Some conveniences we miss, some we don't. And, you know, dishwasher, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
If,
for you.
Well,
no.
You know, when I think about when we had a dishwasher, you know, we could get the kids to put their dishes in it. And it was always an argument or a fight or a chore to have the kids take dishes out to put them away. Now, here, we don't do it all the time, but some of the time, we're both doing the dishes. You know, you
or
wash all dry.
After.
That's what my grandparents used to do. They never had a dishwasher. Mm-hmm. And so we're doing something physical, side by side, we can talk, we're connecting, we're maintaining our relationship as a married couple.
There are times, you know, when the kids were younger, when David would leave the house before 6 a.m. and he wouldn't be back until after 8 p.m.
Right.
I mean, what's left? There's nothing left.
Or if I got home on time. Even
if you got home on time, I'd be like, here, take the kids so I can make dinner. And it would just be...
Or I would see the kids. I'd leave the house before the kids were awake.
You see the kids just before they went to bed.
And it was time to come down to dinner, and I get them at their worst, when they're fried at the end of the day and mommy's done. Not great for building deep, meaningful relationships with anyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
It improved when I was working from home, when I was telecommuting.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, still relatively few people even have that privilege. So I felt lucky then. And now even more so, because, again, we're doing things together that matter.
For us.
Not for everybody.
Yeah.
I think it would be really beneficial to most people, you know, if they had the opportunity to be together in a peaceful environment more often, you know.
You know, we see the neighboring Mennonite families that have dairy farms or grocery stores or construction companies or, you know, whatever it is that they do. And everyone is so nice, and sweet, and polite, and well-mannered, and the children work hard.
Mm-hmm.
And
expected.
They're friendly, and they smile, and they're happy. And they have something mm-hmm. that we didn't realize we were lacking. You know, we had all the material things, but we didn't have the same deep sense of respect or caring for one another, sad to say. I mean, it didn't evidence itself in our behavior to one another. And in comparison, we were really spoiled ourselves by our parents. Not intentionally, perhaps, or with good intentions.
Good intentions, yeah.
But, and our children are really kind of spoiled and coddled in a lot of ways, and part of me wonders what our family would be like if we had made this kind of a move much sooner.
I think our kids are doing great.
Oh, they are, and I mean, they love it here, and it's boy heaven. I mean, ponds and mud and dogs
right.
and wildlife.
I imagine if we were part of a community like the Mennonites and had grown up in that, and then we would be able to take what we knew from growing up, and then we just do that with our kids. So we're kind of learning from scratch mm-hmm. how to cultivate willing helpers and people interested in doing for others, and it's something we're having to learn how to foster.
And luckily you have this whole community around you to help you, you know, and
yeah.
set an example.
It's huge. Yeah.
That's
it's
a key
huge.
Thing, is that because we are here in common for, even though different ages, mm-hmm. different life experiences, that we're all drawn to, we're all here for the core ecological covenants,
mm-hmm.
And this egalitarian, consensus-driven way of being with one another. It's much easier to, getting back to the ecological things like recycling, it's much easier to do it when everyone around you is doing it. When you're in suburbia, like my earlier comment of, you know, just the disparity in the number of recycle bins we had versus what our neighbors had,
mm-hmm.
to garbage cans. It was like, yeah, a lot of times, why are we even bothering?
Mm-hmm.
It's a drop in the bucket. We're not making any difference
yeah.
whatsoever.
Nobody else cares. Why do
Who cares?
Yeah.
Why are we killing ourselves for this? And here, everyone is doing it. Everyone is believing that this is important.
And that matters.
And together, I think we're making a much stronger statement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just, this is a community, it's a tribal community in a lot of ways. And it's much, I think, psychologically, emotionally, it's a lot closer to what humanity had evolved to be.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 150 years of technological progress, has really kind of gotten out of hand in some ways and from some perspectives, and we've gained a tremendous amount. There's no denying that, and I'm fascinated with new technology and new discoveries in a lot of different fields, but we've lost that connection with one another and with our planet, the sense of caring, the sense of responsibility, and that's showing in our behavior to one another, to other countries, to other societies, to the world we live in. And I think that unless we can regain that, somehow, we're lost.
We're doomed. I think that's the hope. I kind of think that, like, peak oil is sort of a blessing in a way, because I think people are going to have to come together more and figure it out.
Whether they want
to or
not.
They're
not
going to have to figure out
anymore.
How to work together to get what they need.
And those who have figured out or relearned how to be with one another, how to deal with conflict, how to feed themselves, how to house themselves,
Right.
I think those are the people who are going to be, not necessarily the new elite, but those are the people who are going to be well off.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a richness for those folks.
Absolutely.
And, you know, call it, you know, the paranoid can call it survival skills, the less paranoid can call it reality, just living, self-sufficiency, the satisfaction that comes from growing your own food and preserving it.
So yeah, we didn't choose this as survivalists. We're not survivalists. But
it's always been, when we first moved into our house in the suburbs, and there were two apple trees, that it was a bumper crop, we had more fun making applesauce and enjoying it over the next couple of years.
And we've always been fascinated by how things were done in the past. I think my parents took me to every old village, you know, like
Williamsburg, Sturbridge.
You know, Iway.
Yeah.
I sometimes wonder why they wonder that I'm so fascinated with canning and stuff, because I went to all these places and I'm like,
making our own candles.
Making candles, you know. Mm-hmm. I grew up being fascinated with
my mother took a fireplace cooking course at the Stone Dolan House.
Oh, and all my parents' furniture when we were growing up was like old dough boxes and, you know, all these antique things. So I guess I grew up really being interested in older ways of doing things.
There was something, in fact, here during the winter when, you know, it's cloudy more and the sun doesn't shine for as long, so you have to really conserve your power for the things that matter, like the pump that circulates the hot water through the floor to keep you warm. You don't turn on the lights. You use the kerosene lamp or you use the candles and you read and you go to bed earlier.
You know what's been kind of nice, though, with that? Like, having limited energy, it's made us kind of have to be more creative about entertaining ourselves. So, you know, there's been nights when we sit around the table and play games, whereas if you have lights, then you can all go to your own rooms and do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, no Game Boys, no Xboxes.
We never did that stuff anyway, but it's been kind of a coming together sort of thing for us, the nights that we don't have power, because then... Okay, there are the five of us. What are we going to do?
Well,
it's snowing out. It's cold. We could...
We have community potluck, knit. A candlelight.
We do, you know, play games, sing songs. I think that's a really kind of fun way to entertain yourself. Certainly feel closer to my boys.
I think we feel a lot closer to each other.
Yeah, that's true.
We're in the same space more often.
Right.
We're doing things that matter.
Well, we're more able to do things together here, I think. And just because this is a smaller house and this room is open, I love the setup of this house, because I used to feel sad at our house that I felt so alone in our kitchen cooking and everybody else would be doing things, and I just felt so isolated. And here, I can hear what the boys are doing in the room, I can hear what's going on out here. And I think that I kind of have this feeling sometimes of being kind of a failure, like, oh my gosh, we went from a 2,200 square foot house to a 570 square foot house. And I kind of have the voices of judgment, like, what are you doing?
To go from you know, two car garage to not even wanting to have a car.
Yeah, what are you doing? That's so like anti everything. And so I have to keep reminding myself every night before I go to bed, like, why do I value this? Mm-hmm. And kind of give myself, like, oh yeah, because I'm with my family more. I feel more connected. This is a house that I'm able to keep up with. I'm not spending all my time maintaining a house.
Dusting and cleaning. We used to have, you know, Saturday clean, and it would take us all freaking day. It would take 2 hours just to vacuum the house.
Yeah.
And here, we do the whole house in a couple, you know, in an hour or hour and a half.
It's not as clean, but...
Well, we're closer to the outdoors. We're tracking in more straw and clay and dust.
It just doesn't matter as much.
But with a cement floor, radiant heat, by the way, is so much more comfortable than forced air furnace.
Yeah,
oh my lord, it is just so much more.
Yeah, there's actually kind of, I thought, oh, I don't want to live in a place with a cement floor, but actually it's been a real nice freedom, because then I don't really care if the kids come in with muddy boots. I mean, I encourage them not to. But it's not a crisis. I haven't ruined a rug. There's no wooden floor that's getting wet.
No water damage on the floor. No.
It's like, oh, good. We can just live here, you know.
Yeah. Dishes break much more spectacularly.
Oh, yes. They do. Much more of an advantage.
Who knew the corral could bounce so high? It could go so far.
And shower so spectacular.
Wow. But but even that, it just, it's a much less, in that way, it's a less forgiving floor.
Mm-hmm.
But it's removed this huge amount of stress over appearance-related things.
And we used to think that our house wasn't big enough to entertain. Like, we had friends who had bigger houses and more spacious and more, and so we're like, oh, we just can't have people
over. Or that were newer or had been more recently remodeled and they put in new hardwoods.
And we've had the best parties since we've been here. We had a naming party for me. There's another Amy here.
Everybody came.
Everybody came.
40 people in this in-between house.
We had everybody.
Really?
It was so funny. All the way into the hallway.
Yeah, it was cheek to elbow.
And everybody stayed for so long.
Hours.
Yeah.
And everybody had a great time.
And then more recently, we had an old fogies night where, because we mentioned, like, a Henry Mancini saw the baby elephant walk, and some of the young folks around here didn't know, like, okay, we've got
to. We're showing our age again.
So everybody kind of dressed, old.
The idea was to have a cocktail party the way our parents used to. When we would sneak to the head of the stairs and try to listen in, or
and kind
of sneak downstairs and get the fancy hors d'oeuvres with the cream cheese pushed into the celery. The asparagus rolled up in the ham, and it just...
It was so fun. And we never would have thought of doing that at our house. We never entertained. And we were so busy,
But it was hard to get people together.
Yeah, it was hard to get people together.
We'd pick a date, and some people could make it, some people couldn't. Here, we schedule it at the Sunday meeting, and everybody shows up.
Yeah,
it's so fun.
It's marvelous.
Yeah,
it's
wonderful.
Yeah.
So, you said we've answered a lot of your questions. I don't know if you want to look through and see if there's anything else.
No, this has been a wonderful interview.
It's been a little strange. I think, again, because of the dearth of available housing, and this is, I think, the third or fourth largest building here of... the rest are like they're small one person places, or you have to, again, if you're gonna build something new, there isn't anything extra. If you're gonna build something, you have to camp in the meanwhile. Yes, Morgan.
Could I borrow Java, please?
The game? No.
Why not?
I still have to cut apart the pieces and figure it out.
I can do. Me and Blake are interested in playing.
I understand. You and
would you be willing to hear the answer no, and then talk to Daddy later after this interview about it?
You're welcome to borrow El Grande. There's a copy of Settlers in the game closet. We'll talk later.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep.
What was I saying? Oh, that it's... It really is almost self-selecting for young single people.
Mm-hmm.
So to be married with kids is really an anomaly here. But our hope is that as this community matures and more people are here and more housing is built, that it becomes easier for more mainstream, traditional families to make this kind of a shift, or to be inspired by this kind of a shift, even if they don't do it here, if they do it somewhere else. Because I think there's a lot here that has been missing, we lost in this country. I was talking with one of my clients at a meeting in New York recently, and that's the other thing. I've been traveling by train instead of by plane, because it's much more energy efficient to travel by train. It takes longer.
Mm-hmm.
I have no fear of flying. Flying is fine, personally. But again, it's to go higher, faster, takes more energy.
Mm-hmm.
And the train has been so enjoyable. it's you don't have the same disjointed feeling of, you know, you wake up in Chicago and you go to bed in New York.
Right.
There is more of that sense of journey, and you're mm-hmm. talking with the people that you're traveling with, or you can sleep or read or work on the train. And so again, there's more of that sense of continuity. It's much more relaxing, much less jolting mm-hmm. to the psyche. But I was talking with a bunch of members of this board, of this client, and about Dancing Rabbit and some of the things that we were doing here. And that, oh, by the way, I've moved. And most of these people themselves are from Europe. And they're working in the U.S. or they're U.S. citizens now, but they've come from all over the world. And a surprising number of them said, oh, well, that sounds like the village I grew up in Belgium.
Really?
Because a lot of my sense from talking with them more is that in Europe, they didn't have this same huge suburban development that we've mm-hmm. had in this country. And that Europe is still predominantly cities and then rural hamlets mm-hmm. with a lot of farmland. And they're not trucking their produce from 2,000 miles away. It's coming from 50 miles away.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's because they're older countries, and older their mm-hmm. infrastructure was developed at the time before automobiles, whereas a lot of our country was kind of developed after.
Right. After the automobile, or in yeah. conjunction with the automobile.
Right.
And for them, the fact that I prefer rail travel over airplane doesn't seem strange to them, because in Europe you travel by rail.
Right, yeah.
Which is easier to do because it's subsidized by the government and it's not.
Well, it's also they have a more extensive rail infrastructure.
Because yeah. it's subsidized by the government.
Right.
Whereas our air travel is subsidized by
the government. Well, right. And in Europe, yeah, the money has gone into rail. Here it's gone into automobile infrastructure or supporting the, mm-hmm. the airlines. Amtrak gets government support as well, but not nearly to the degree that the airlines do, or that, you know, just maintaining bridges and mm-hmm. tunnels and the superhighways does. So. I just found I was kind of a little leery of telling them even that this is what I've done. I was worried about what their response would be, and it kind of their acceptance of it, and oh well, yeah, of course, just kind of surprised me, which was nice, because that's not the reaction I had from most people in this country.
Right, I'm sure. Good. Well, you certainly answered all my questions. Thank
and
you
more.
Very
you welcome.
Much.
You are welcome.
It was wonderful. I learned a lot.
So what got you onto this? You can stop recording if you want.